Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, it changed the landscape for abortion services. Some states like Illinois have seen a big uptick in people coming here for abortions, but it's not made up for the decrease in other Midwestern states where restrictions have been approved. We'll have a report. Auctions, they've been more than just a place to exchange goods. In many rural areas, they're a social event, but more of them are going online. A court decision has changed what's considered a wetland under the U.S. Clean Water Act. We'll discuss that. A widow recounts her husband's story of what he witnessed on D-Day. And what are law enforcement officials in the Chicago area learning about the rise in carjackings? Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. After a massive spike in carjackings in the Chicago area in 2020, law enforcement created a new task force. Numbers from the Cook County Sheriff's Office shows they're now recovering a higher number of the stolen vehicles. Officials say that's giving them a better picture of who is doing the carjacking and why. Patrick Smith sat down with Ro Khan, who heads the task force for the Sheriff's Office.
When carjacking started spiking a few years ago, then Police Superintendent David Brown blamed the increase on thrill-seeking kids.
It's a shame that you hold a gun in someone's head just to joyride, but that seems to be what our young people are doing that we're capturing.
It was around that time the Chicago Police Department, the Cook County Sheriff, state police, suburban departments, and the FBI started cooperating in the Anti-Carjacking Task Force. The Sheriff's Office acts as the hub for the cooperation. And Ro Khan is a former radio host who is now the director of data-driven strategies for the sheriff.
Really, the most important thing we can do is we can map it. You can see where these incidents are happening. You can see where they're terminating. You can see where cars are being recovered. So it gives law enforcement a better sense, especially our partners in the Chicago Police Department, where 9 out of 10 of the cases of carjacking are happening in Chicago. It gives them a sense of where they can be to recover cars or where they can patrol to try to at least stem some of the tide.
That data sharing hasn't helped improve the arrest rate by much. It's still under 10% based on City of Chicago data, but carjackings are dropping.
I mean, when we started this in 2021, we had more carjacking incidents in Chicago than we probably had almost anywhere in the world. There were 2,100 carjacking incidents in Cook County alone. Now, we still have more than we want to have, but the incidents keep descending. We're down almost 40% down from where we were in 2021. But I think the most important number is the percentage of recoveries. Before 2021, we were recovering about 40% of cars. Now we recover over 80% of cars, close to 90% of cars. And we get them in a much shorter period of time.
And the fact that those cars are being recovered dispels a myth about carjackings, that they're being sold on the black market. Cars that are being abandoned were obviously not stolen for resale. Instead, Khan says the cars are often being used to commit other crimes.
Whether it's another carjacking, whether it's shootings, homicides, kidnappings, narcotics, transportation. There is a sense out there that there are cars that are just being stolen so that they can be resold in other states or around the world somewhere. And we do see that, but it's by far the vast minority of these cases.
Khan says in addition to data, like what kinds of cars are being stolen, where and when they're being stolen and recovered, the task force has been doing anonymous interviews with folks who have been convicted of carjacking.
There are specialized crews that do this based on our interviews, and we think that they're responsible for well over half.
Khan says Brown, the former police superintendent, was right. There are a lot of young people involved in the thefts, but he was wrong about the motivations. They're not just joyriding. The kids are being used by organized crews.
There are a lot of juveniles that are actually getting arrested in these stolen or hijacked cars. And that may be a function less of the juvenile actually doing the carjacking, but the juvenile being put in to the car after the carjacking to drive the car away, because the consequences for a juvenile are very different than they are for an adult. So it may look like it's about joyriding, but it is really not.
Rogue Khan with the Cook County Sheriff's Office, talking with Patrick Smith about a relatively new task force that deals with carjackings in the Chicago area. The new Illinois state budget includes $250 million for early childhood programs. Some of that will support early intervention services for Illinois' youngest children with disabilities. Peter Medlin reports on why it's so challenging for families to get their kids with disabilities the care they need.
A few years ago, Roma Gardner and her baby moved to DeKalb all the way from Ghana in West Africa. As she was settling in, Roma began to notice some delays with her son Luke, who was a year old. But she couldn't quite put her finger on it. He had met all the developmental milestones up to that point. One day at the library, a woman from 4C, Community Coordinated Childcare, handed Gardner a pamphlet. And when she called, they told her about their free developmental screenings.
They came in with their therapist, they screened him, they realized he had a speech delay, he had some occupational therapy needs, fine motor delay.
Her son needed three early intervention services, developmental, speech, and occupational therapy. She had no idea. She didn't even know these programs existed. At her income level, it was free, and it happened completely by chance.
Seeing so much progress. When we started, he was not even saying up to two words. Now he's saying so many words, all his colors, counting to 20, alphabets, and speaking without prompts. He's signing words that are really powerful and important. He's more regulated.
Early childhood professionals call that a success. But that's not always the story in Illinois.
There has been, for quite some time, not enough providers to take care of all the services that are required for families throughout the state.
That's Angela Hodges. She's the program manager of Child and Family Connections number 3 in Northern Illinois. She supervises early intervention case managers and, because of staffing shortages, has a full caseload herself. In 6 counties, all early intervention referrals run through her office. So a parent or pediatrician notices a developmental delay, sends it to Hodges, who helps the family connect with a therapist. Hodges' agency serves just over 500 Northern Illinois families, mostly in DeKalb County. And there are 16 early intervention services they can provide, with speech therapy being the most common. And the law states that within 30 days of writing a family plan, deciding which services they need, children should begin receiving services.
Maybe 10% are waiting more than 45 days, up to, I think in some areas, probably higher.
There are tens of thousands of kids statewide receiving services, and sometimes it can even take months to assess whether they need early intervention at all. Hodges says they serve more kids now than pre-pandemic, but with less staff. It's why waitlists have returned over the past 9 months. And even if they can line up a therapist for a family, it might not be convenient. A lot of early interventions happen in a child's home, but sometimes it's not possible. Hodges says she knows in Bureau County there are families who have to drive an hour to Peoria twice a week to receive services for their kids. Otherwise, since the pandemic, they can offer families a virtual therapy option. Samantha McDavid is the regional council manager for Birth to Five Illinois' DeKalb County region.
There are some therapies, like speech especially, that over a screen are just never going to be as effective.
Many families aren't interested in virtual therapy. Dan Coffey is the president and CEO of Service Inc. It's a nonprofit that runs another Child and Family Connections in Northern Illinois. And he says they have a lot of families who refuse video therapies, but because they're technically turning down services, they're no longer on a wait list. Some kids get early intervention services at a daycare, too. Agnieszka Moroni is a pediatric occupational therapist.
Playing is the major occupation for kids.
She's been going into homes providing early intervention for the past 8 years in the Chicago suburbs.
The nice thing about being in the homes versus other settings is I see the setup of their crib. I see their setup of their high chair at the table, right? So like if we're talking about sleeping, I'm there. I can see it. I can problem solve with the bed.
Finding daycare is really hard, especially for families of kids with disabilities. And some daycare centers don't allow therapists, so the kid just doesn't get therapy at all. Some let her in, but with limited space. And Moroni says kids with disabilities essentially get kicked out of some daycares because the centers realize they don't have the staff to support them. And after years of hearing those stories, she decided to start her own daycare for kids with disabilities. Early intervention services aren't always free either, like they were for Roma Gardner and her son. Hodges says family fees were paused during the pandemic, but are likely to return this summer. Depending on the family income, it could cost up to $200 a month, plus the cost of daycare. But despite the complexities, program manager Angela Hodges says parents and caregivers are the experts on their kids, and if they feel like something isn't developing appropriately, to trust their gut. I'm Peter Medlin.
A Central Illinois state lawmaker says there are a number of things he liked in the state budget that lawmakers approved, but there is a lot more he doesn't like. State Senator Tom Bennett voted against the $50 billion budget, as did each of his Republican colleagues. Bennett told Eric Stock he supports the investment in higher education, tax credits for volunteer firefighters, and changes in teacher licensing, but he doesn't like how Republicans were largely shut out of negotiations.
I've been there 8-9 years now, I guess, and every time we start with the Democrats and Republicans starting to work together, say we want to have a compromise or a budget that works for everybody. And I think that's what the people in the state of Illinois, Eric, want to hear and want to see. And so we've started that way, but things seem to happen every time to where we get down to the last day, last hours, where finally that cooperation stops. And then the Democrats close the door and they work on their budgets and they end up with something that was not exactly what we expected to see when they brought it out. And along with the process, what I'm concerned about is the whole transparency piece. Over 3,000 pages, and Eric, there's no graphics, there's no pictures, no charts, just a whole lot of words, a lot of pages, and we're still trying to work through what's all in there. But there wasn't a whole lot of time to respond, to react, and that whole lack of transparency, I would think, would really concern every person in the state of Illinois. We could do so much better with this.
Are there certain things in the budget that or were there certain things not in the budget that you wanted to see?
Well, the first couple of things that come to my mind was the undocumented immigrant services, and I think maybe we might touch on that a little bit later, but if we can, that was in the budget, so let's maybe talk about that now if we could.
So, yeah, you did not want that in there.
The thing is, it was priorities, and the Democrats would rather prioritize spending $700 million on programs for non-citizens, like free health care, housing, and other services, than fully fund, for example, our developmentally disabled community. It's money that could be put to better use providing services for the developmentally disabled, a community that's been underfunded and neglected in the budget for years. It really has. When these workers can make more money working in an Amazon warehouse, facilities go understaffed or they close and residents suffer. Illinois ranks 49th out of 50 states for funding and support for more than 300,000 in Illinois with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And the wait list for services is almost 15,000 people long. Along with that, we have over 5,500 people eligible for community-based services, but there's no place to go. So that's an example where we need to really think about the priorities of what Illinois needs to be.
A bill that did pass in the House this past session did not get a Senate vote that would allow judges to force anyone to surrender their weapon if there's an order of protection against them. If that were to come up for a vote in the Senate, would you support it?
There's a number of things. So it amended the Illinois Domestic Violence Act, which I think you're referring to. It amended the FOID Card Act, amended the FOID Card, the Card Act. It also amended the Illinois Insurance Code, and there were a number of concerns about that. And one thing that kind of jumped out at me as well was they're talking about a task force on firearm insurance to review current and potential future insurance policy offerings for the safe and legal possession of firearms and other policy-making recommendations. And to have insurance on gun owners because of the guns they have, that really seems to be just against the whole idea of the Second Amendment sort of thing. It's in the Constitution, and that was a concern I had.
So that would hold them more legally liable if something were to go wrong?
Well, it was more in terms of just the Second Amendment rights that we have already in the Constitution. If it impacts their ability to pay and all sorts of things. And also there's an additional bill in the courts right now that are dealing with some of these kinds of things, and we'll see where all that plays out. But along with that, the bill doesn't really do anything to address the carjackings that we've seen, just a super rising number here, armed robberies, home invasions, gang-related shootings that are plaguing the state, and of course, the use of violence and guns. That doesn't seem to impact anything what this bill is trying to deal with.
When you refer to all of that crime, are you referring to your district, Central Illinois, statewide, Chicago?
what we see in Illinois. And of course, some of it is seen in the northern part of the state.
So if we can go back to going back to the insurance aspect of this, how does that expanded legal liability, if something goes wrong, how do you feel that infringes on the Second Amendment?
Well, in terms of it impacts the ability of someone who has the okay, the ability to own guns, to have insurance on that, that seems to fly in the face of the Second Amendment. So how though? Well, if it impacts what they have to do, I mean, they already have, it costs, of course, to buy guns, but how's the insurance in terms of the Second Amendment, where it should keep the freedom, the ability to own guns? This seems like a real potential for keeping people from being able to have that, depending on the cost and all sorts of things. But it's like another restriction, another limitation that's impacting the Second Amendment.
That's State Senator Tom Bennett, the Republican, speaking with Eric Stock. Bennett says he also wants to see the legislature consider extending the scholarship tax credit program for private schools. And he wants to fund a program to offer relief for Ameren customers paying higher utility bills. The Quad Cities Salvation Army has completed one task in response to the Davenport partial building collapse. Michelle O'Neill reports it's just getting started with a more difficult problem, finding permanent housing for displaced tenants.
Spokeswoman Patty Mixdorf says after feeding emergency personnel for 5 days, the Salvation Army is regrouping.
Everyone, not just the Army, we are working with the several families we've started to do casework with and to try and help them find apartments. But then it starts with home, you know, things for their new apartments. A lot of them don't have anything left.
Finding apartments for displaced tenants will not be easy.
It's bad. And we work, of course, with Humility and Mary and Project Now and everyone to find places for displaced folks. Or right now, the apartment situation is so tight. And we pay for the rent for folks that come into our system. And we have terrible trouble finding apartments because they're so expensive right now.
And she emphasizes all the Quad Cities housing nonprofits are in the same boat. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
There's more to come on Statewide. Stick around. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The uptick in legal abortions in states like Illinois have not made up for a decrease in states like Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky that implemented post-Roe restrictions. That's according to a recent report. Farah Yousri with Side Effects Public Media tells us how the shifting abortion landscape drove abortion numbers down as providers navigated changes.
The staff at Trust Women Clinic in Wichita, Kansas, can't keep up with the nonstop phones ringing some days. Ever since the Supreme Court overturned federal abortion protections last summer, clinic director Ashley Brink says they've had a math problem. Too many patients desperate for care, but limited time and resources to see them.
We're averaging about 500 patients a month, give or take.
Of those 500 patients, she says 400 come from out of state. And that's because since Roe fell, it's been up to each state to make its own abortion laws. In Kansas, abortion access was saved by a ballot vote, but more than a dozen other states issued bans or severe restrictions. Now, the Wichita Clinic has become an abortion haven for women in states like Texas, Missouri, Kentucky, and Oklahoma, where abortion is banned. Brink says the clinic had to adapt.
We had to change literally everything about our organization.
They tripled their staff, added more work days, and made some difficult cuts.
We've stopped providing, OBGYN care or gender-affirming care because we felt like we are one of the only clinics in the area that can provide abortion care.
Other states in the Midwest where abortion is protected, like Michigan and Illinois, have seen similar spikes in the number of abortions provided and patients traveling hundreds of miles for care. But overall, the number of legal abortions nationwide in the 6 months post-Roe fell by as much as 6%, according to the latest data. Dr. Allison Norris is an epidemiologist at Ohio State University and the co-author of a new report called We Count. It's the most comprehensive and up-to-date picture that we have of abortion numbers today.
The overall picture is one of a somewhat chaotic environment in which we know that the people who have the least resources are the most burdened and will find it the most hard to get the care that they need.
She says the increased capacity in states like Kansas has not made up for the decrease in abortions in states with bans or restrictions, meaning
some people will be forced to stay pregnant and will have a birth that they didn't intend to have.
The data also suggests that the number of abortions happening via telemedicine has more than doubled. Planned Parenthood Great Plains started new telehealth services in Kansas. Dr. Iman Al-Sadin is the clinic's medical director.
We are doing our best to expand and adapt, and we've been really, truly jumping from putting out fire to fire. I mean, yeah, it's been really difficult.
Difficult because laws keep changing. Some states have yo-yoed back and forth between a ban and a stay on abortion access, and that leaves patients confused on where to go for care. Sometimes that means people look outside the healthcare system and order abortion pills online. The new report does not account for self-managed abortions, and the authors recognize that limitation. But they say that while requests for abortion pills from overseas pharmacies are up, we don't know whether all requests get filled, whether the pills are used to terminate a pregnancy, or whether people perhaps order the pills and just hang on to them. Allison Case is a family medicine physician in Indiana who also provides abortion care. She says self-managed medication abortion early in pregnancy is very safe, but
we want to make sure people can get the help they need. Like if they do have a complication with a self-managed abortion, you want to make sure they can get help and know to seek help.
Social media is flush with anonymous posts from people looking for guidance on self-managed abortions. Some say they're alone and scared. At times, the only solace they have comes from other anonymous social media users who share advice. Farah Yusri, Side Effects Public Media.
That story comes from a partnership with Side Effects Public Media and the Midwest Newsroom. Galesburg's Cottage Hospital closed its doors in January of last year. Within a few months after that, Cottage's affiliated clinics had also all closed, including the Women's Health Clinic. Eleanor Lindenmeyer tells us how it impacted access to birth control in the Galesburg and Monmouth area.
The Cottage Hospital closure left the area with OSF Healthcare as the primary provider. OSF is a Catholic ministry. They offer fertility awareness-based methods of family planning, but do not promote contraceptive practices. Cottage did provide contraceptive services, so other clinics have had to step up since the closure. Ashley German is the executive director of the Sexual Health Clinic Family Planning Services of Western Illinois. It is a nonprofit that has been serving Galesburg and the surrounding area since 1976 for little to no cost, regardless of insurance.
It was interesting to see how it played out. We were expecting, when Cottage closed in January of 22, we were expecting kind of this mad influx all at once. But what we saw was more the women that had already had their annuals planned, or they were going back for their shot, or birth control refill, and they no longer had that option.
German says they saw many new patients in May and June after the Cottage Women's Health Clinic closed, as people realized there was nowhere else in town for birth control services. Two new clinics also opened in Galesburg later in the year. Solvera Health opened in July and offers the pill, the patch, the vaginal ring, the implant, but not the IUD. Graham Medical Group opened a clinic in September. It has an on-site women's health provider and offers all FDA-approved birth control options. German says Family Planning Services is building a relationship with Graham. She says they are lucky that there is a nearby clinic that shares their philosophy about access to sexual health care.
So there's reproductive care that needs further evaluation that we can't do. So we want to be able to provide that easy referral process to everyone that comes in our door.
In Monmouth, McDonough District Hospital opened a clinic in October. MDH offers obstetrics and gynecology once a month, and some birth control options can be prescribed by their regular nurse practitioner. Birth control access was increased further with the opening of the Eagle View Community Health System Clinic in downtown Monmouth in early 2023. Eagle View is based in Aquaca. They had been planning to add a location in Monmouth for some time, and the closure of Cottage spurred them to complete the process. Public Relations Director Emily Higgins says they offer the pill, the implant, the shot, and IUDs.
With the closing of Cottage, there was a significant decrease in the ability to access birth control. Due to so many individuals being left without their primary care providers seemingly overnight, other health organizations in the area soon found themselves overrun with patients who needed appointments.
Higgins says Eagle View believes everyone deserves access to these important services. She says they aim to support the underserved populations in Western Illinois. Historically, both Eagle View and Family Planning Services have served a largely younger and lower-income population. But German says with the closure of Cottage Hospital, this seems to be shifting.
We're finding that our population ages have changed, which is interesting because it always used to be kind of high school, early college, which we still have those pockets very much. But now we're into the 30, 35, 40 range of women. They're done having kids, but yet they still need, they haven't hit menopause yet, so they're still needing care.
German says that many of these older patients used to come to the clinic as teenagers and college students, but switched to Cottage once becoming adults. And now they are back. Family Planning Services has done a lot of community outreach lately and is working on an expansion.
So we try to bridge those gaps because we do see clients from all over. We are not county bound.
They're working with Graham to offer services on the Knox College campus and are in the process of developing a mobile unit so they can bring the care to the people who need it most. I'm Eleanor Lindenmeyer.
The U.S. Supreme Court is due to rule on the fate of affirmative action in college admissions this month. Two cases before the justices challenged the consideration of race, one of them on the basis that it discriminates against Asian American applicants. For decades, Asian Americans have been cast, often unwillingly, as victims of affirmative action. That's despite the fact they've often benefited from the policy intended to bring more underrepresented minorities onto college campuses. Higher education researcher Ooyeon Poon has examined the Asian American community's role in the policy debate for much of her career. She shared her reflections as a scholar, activist, and Chinese American with Lisa Phillip.
Ooyeon, let's start with a little history. In the 1980s, Asian American students noticed their numbers were flatlining at selective universities. That's as the number of white students admitted appeared to be increasing. What happened next?
Demographically, our country was continually getting more diverse. And so these young people asked for investigations into whether this was happening, an anti-Asian bias in favor of white applicants. However, what ended up happening was conservative politicians seized onto it and said, yeah, because of affirmative action, that's why Asian Americans are being harmed. And these young people, these young Asian American student activists were like, we never said that. We are saying affirmative action is absolutely essential and vital. Every time I go talk to a group of people about these cases, I always start by asking, how many of you think Asian Americans are suing Harvard? And almost every hand goes up. And then I show a picture of Ed Blum. And then people are very shocked that they've been bamboozled.
Ed Blum is a white man and conservative legal activist who founded Students for Fair Admissions. That's the plaintiff in the two Supreme Court cases. Why do you think Blum has positioned Asian Americans as victims of affirmative action?
It goes back to the model that was used in the 80s. If you put forward a face of an image of a stereotype of Asian Americans, then anti-affirmative action forces who are predominantly white can deflect claims that they are racist. If they're fighting for this community of color, how can they be racist is the idea. I don't need them to fight for me, though.
Opponents of affirmative action have painted a picture of Asian Americans as largely critical of the policy. But what did your research reveal?
Our people in this community have played central roles in the development and history of affirmative action. And political opinion polls continue to find support. Yet, if you look up Google images or news of just searching Asian Americans in affirmative action, the images that will pop up are these very activated, very passionate groups of mostly Chinese Americans who are out there protesting, rallying. They represent a very small minority of Asian Americans is being lifted up in the national discourse and making it seem like all of us, Indian Americans, other Chinese Americans, Vietnamese people, Filipinos, again, it's triggering into those stereotypes and biases.
How do you think this flattening of the community impacts actual Asian American students?
A friend of mine actually said that she's really afraid that our children are going to be seen as the enemy of racial justice and progress. When you know that your community has benefited greatly from an anti-racist policy like affirmative action, and you have these other people using your face and your image to then destroy the policies that were so central to the progress in your community, the benefits in your family. It's not okay. It feels like there's nothing that can be done right now other than just wait and just keep fighting and hope that those fractures that these outsiders are trying to create, they can be healed.
That's higher education researcher Oyan Poon. She spoke with Lisa Phillip. A Central Illinois woman from Normal marked the anniversary of D-Day this week, sharing her late husband's story. Eric Stock has this report.
The story is really about Bob Moniger, but it's told partly by his wife, Eleanor. Bob Moniger was part of the second wave of U.S. and Allied forces that stormed the beaches at Normandy, France, 79 years ago. Eleanor says she encouraged him to preserve his recollections for future generations.
He never did talk much about it, but I said, you've got to write this down so somebody will know what you went through.
Bob Moniger wrote about the so-called longest day many years later. The Normal Light newspaper published his account 2 years ago. Moniger recalls how difficult it was to climb down the rope ladders as they got off their ship, quote, with all the equipment I was carrying and the sea being so rough. He noticed one soldier getting his leg and foot smashed between two ships that were, quote, bobbing around like a cork in the ocean. Moniger was part of a team that had to find a position for more than 150 howitzer artillery weapons once they reached landfall. When the fighting began, Moniger said he saw several wounded soldiers on the beach and bodies in the water. He also watched a truck fail to negotiate a steep hill. The truck rolled and bodies spilled out. He said he wondered if he had shared the same shelter on the beach with one of them that morning, or maybe had a beer with one of them the month before. He also saw German bodies and wondered if one of them could have been shooting at him a few hours earlier. Eleanor Moniger says her husband later acknowledged the fear he felt that day, but it did not overtake him.
Somebody asked him once we were on a tour, said, you must have been terrified. He said, well, I wasn't really terrified. I'd been through two other invasions, so I knew what was going to happen, but it was scary, but I wasn't terrified.
Bob Moniger survived D-Day and went on to fight several more battles during World War II before several bouts of malaria took him off the battlefield, as wife Eleanor explains.
Went to a hospital in Paris, and then he went to one back in London, and he was there for about 6 weeks. And in January, he wrote to his mom and dad, and he said, get out of my bed, I'm coming home. I bet he liked writing that to his mom.
Bob Moniger said he considered himself very lucky to come home with no injuries after 440 days of combat. He returned home to Macomb. He and Eleanor both grew up there. Eleanor was working on the family farm at the time. Eleanor says she received updates in the mail about how Bob was doing, and she waited for his return, though not in the storybook way wartime reunions are often portrayed on TV and the movies.
I knew him before he left, but I didn't really... It really wasn't one of those big romances. We just got to writing each other, and he's wanting to know if I'd hang around and wait on him. I guess nobody else. He had nobody else to wait. And we just got to writing. So when he came home, we got married about a month after he was home.
The Monigers both worked for Illinois State University. She was in food service. He worked at the university heating plant for 25 years. The Monigers have three children. One of them served in the Navy during the Vietnam War. All are retired now. Bob Moniger died in 2002. Eleanor is now 98, and she wants to make sure the heroism of her husband and so many others who helped liberate Europe from Nazi occupation is never forgotten.
He took part in one of the biggest military operations in history and lived through it. He always said that. He said, I'm glad I took part in it, but I wouldn't want to do it again.
Eleanor Moniger says she once had her car's license plate number June 6, 44 to mark the anniversary of D-Day. She says someone saw that and thought her name was June. She's concerned many no longer know what the day represents. I'm Eric Stock.
More ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A 5-4 U.S. Supreme Court ruling last month essentially says a wetland not connected to a lake, river, or stream is not subject to the conditions of the Federal Clean Water Act. That decision, if not challenged by lawmakers, could lead to destruction of wetlands throughout Illinois, says Paul Botts. He's president and executive director of the Chicago-based The Wetlands Initiative. He says if that happens, it could mean reduction in flood control. He spoke with Maureen McKinney in a recent interview.
It is a major ruling, and I'm sorry to say, not in a good way. Literally every day since that ruling was issued, I have been on calls, discussions with colleagues, not just around the Midwest, but around the whole country, very concerned about it and talking about how to try to respond to it. But it really is two different rulings, sort of combined in a strange way, and neither of those rulings is a good thing from our perspective. One of them, the Sacketts, which is a couple in Idaho, and they wanted to fill in a small wetland on the property they bought, and the EPA came in, and actually I believe had started to fill in the wetland, and the EPA came in and said, wait, that's a wetland, you can't do that without a permit, and so they sued. It was years ago now. It's worked its way up to the Supreme Court. In that case, the small wetland on the Sacketts property was what I would say is, it was a geographically isolated wetland, of which there are many, many, many in nature. And these are wetlands which are not only not directly connected to a river or lake or ocean, but aren't even right next to a river, lake, or ocean. They are out in the middle of the forest, out in the middle of the prairie, out in the middle of anywhere. Those wetlands have all the same functions as the obvious wetlands. In many cases, those wetlands are in fact connected in various ways to the river, lake, stream, but it isn't obvious. It is in different ways. It's about the flow of groundwater. It's about the movement of biota between different wetlands. To us, they're all connected in different ways, so to call them isolated is sort of a false way of looking at it, but they are geographically isolated. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court in the Sackett ruling, without really offering any comment or explanation, actually agreed unanimously, 9-0, that the EPA overreached in the case, the Sackett's particular instance. And effectively, that means that the Supreme Court has ruled unanimously that geographically isolated or apparently isolated wetlands are not covered under the current Clean Water Act. Sort of a nail in the coffin of the idea that those wetlands count as wetlands under federal clean water law. So then, having done that, though, five of the court's justices went a giant step further. And this is the part where they got dissented from this. We agree that in the Sackett's case, the EPA overreached. But then they say, we do not agree with the majority's additional conclusion, which is that a wetland which is right next to a water of the U.S., so a wetland which is literally right next to a navigable river, but if that wetland had to be separated from that river by, they use the word berm, or a dune, or I would say a levee, anything like that, could be narrow, could be just, you know, a 10-foot wide strip of earth that doesn't have to be natural, could be man-made, whatever. The majority thinks that that makes this wetland not a wetland, and that is a new and novel interpretation. The poster childs for, in my view, the absurdity of this conclusion are actually in central Illinois. One of them is a place that my organization proudly owns and manages, which is called the Dixon Waterfowl Refuge, which is on the Illinois River just south of Hennepin, Illinois. Another is a very even large, and that's quite a large place, but even larger place with a lot of similarities is called Emmequon. It's about 45 minutes south of Peoria, down on the Illinois River. Both of these places are huge wetlands that happen to be separated from the Illinois River by a man-made levee. But the bottom line is, it is separated. The Supreme Court majority seems to have just declared that neither Emmequon nor the Dixon Waterfowl Refuge is a wetland for the purposes of federal law. I would point out that both of those places are, in fact, on the international list of the most important wetlands in the world, and that list is literally called Wetlands of International Importance.
Why is this a problem in terms of what the wetlands do?
Well, because wetlands are a particularly highly productive and valuable part of our natural heritage, our landscape, Wetlands do flood control. Wetlands can help with various kinds of pollution, most notably here in the Midwest, the enormous excessive nutrients running off of our farm fields. Wetlands can be an enormous positive natural way to deal with that. And under the Supreme Court majority's new definition, there are many wetlands which are right alongside rivers and creeks and lakes across the Midwest, which I think any sensible person would look at and say that is a wetland. I mean, we're talking open water right next to a stream here. But if it happens to have a little dune in between it and the stream or a little levee or something, it is wide open. That landowner, as far as federal law is concerned, can call out the bulldozers, fill that thing in, doesn't need a permit, and that wetland is gone. This seems to open up lots of new acres of wetlands to open them up for destruction.
Do you think there's anything that can be done at a state level to protect the particular?
Yes. Now, to be clear, Dixon Waterfowl Refuge and Emequon are both owned by conservation organizations. And in both cases, I happen to know those properties, or at least most of those properties, have on them what are called permanent conservation easements, which means those properties themselves are not actually at risk in the way I just described. But there are other properties along our rivers that are not owned by conservation organizations and are wetlands, and could be beautiful wetlands with some restoration love. But yeah, what could be done is, and you'd say at the state level, and that's at the moment, that is the most practical place, because this is not the Supreme Court saying under our Constitution wetlands cannot be protected or anything like that. This is just interpreting the federal law that Congress passed. So they've said that a whole lot of wetlands are in fact not legally protected under the Clean Water Act. That means states can protect them. That idea in some form will be introduced in Springfield. That's being discussed and explored, and people are hard at work on it right now in various organizations around the state, and this has been an idea that's been around for some years. The answer last year when this came up in some discussions was, well, we can't really try to do that till we see what the U.S. Supreme Court does. So everybody said, well, there's no point writing a state bill because Supreme Court federal law takes precedence, so we have to see what they do or don't do. Well, now we've seen it.
Farmers were saying that the EPA was doing overreach in their decision and in the Sackett case. What would you say to that?
Bottom line is, under our laws, in our society, different good things often come in conflict and have to be balanced. And that is, in fact, actually the premise of the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act, originally in 1972 and again when it was updated in 1977, really did not make it very clear at all what wetlands are included under the Clean Water Act beyond the ones that are just literally part of the river, lake, whatever it is. A society that values many different valuable things, of which farms and farming is certainly one, you have to make trade-offs. It's just like zoning in a way. And where I live, you're not allowed to build a brand new liquor store right next to the public elementary school. The property owner who wants to build that liquor store next to the public elementary school may not be happy about this. But, you know, these are trade-offs. No one is trying to get rid of private property rights or anything like that. Wetlands are highly valuable and productive. And the other point to make, too, and we, my organization, we talk with farmers all the time. We have a project where we are helping farmers create new wetlands, place new wetlands on their working farms, not taking their farms out of production, putting a wetland on the working farm where it makes sense for everybody, including the farmer. So we are talking with farmers all the time. One of the things that we talk about, and we're learning that the farmers agree with, is that the climate has already changed. Farmers know this. They can feel it. Nobody can feel it and see it better than a farmer. Having some wetlands across a big landscape is a really positive thing for successfully adapting when the climate is changing all around you. Wetlands help reduce your flood problem. They can help treat certain kinds of pollution just naturally. They can help pollinators, which everybody needs. There's all these different benefits from wetlands. Across a big landscape such as the Midwest, if anything, it's becoming more and more important to preserve and make use of and be able to work with lots of these wetlands scattered across our landscape because our climate is changing.
That's Paul Botts, president and executive director of the Wetlands Initiative, and he spoke about a U.S. Supreme Court decision negatively affecting wetlands. The ruling's applauded by the Illinois Farm Bureau for bringing clarity to what is considered a wetland under the U.S. Clean Water Act. Auctions are a live marketplace for knickknacks, land, and everything in between. And for rural communities, they're also a social event. Elizabeth Rimberts with Harvest Public Media reports those interactions are increasingly going online.
You can hear the auctioneer even before you make it up the driveway to a Nebraska farmhouse. A farmer is retiring. His tractors, four-wheeler, and skid loader are parked in rows outside a barn, waiting to be sold to the highest bidder. A couple hundred people crowd into a machine shed to browse equipment. Anthony Taney has his eye on a few things, but he's already been outbid on fishing equipment he wanted for his grandkids.
No, there's a guy that got it.
Many people in the crowd know each other and catch up over cups of coffee from the lunch stand. But they're not the only ones looking for a deal. Bidders are logging on from as far away as Montana to make an offer. Online transactions have become a big part of the auction business. The National Auctioneers Association estimates 70% of the industry's $3 billion in sales comes from the web. It's been a growing trend since eBay came onto the scene in 1995, and then the pandemic cemented online sales, says Nancy Kripe, who runs GRS Auctions.
Suddenly, you couldn't have a live auction. You couldn't have people into your place. And so auctioneers had to regroup.
Turns out, it's also just good business. Auctioneers say items go for as much as 50% more online than they do at purely in-person sales.
I think online is never going to go away. It's a stronger component. It brings in a wider audience. It really brings more return to the sellers.
More buyers equals more bids equals a higher price. Roy Montgomery is a third-generation auctioneer who's seen a lot of changes in the business over 40 years. Today, he pretty much only does internet auctions, with buyers bidding online and then picking up their treasures from his shop or opting to have them shipped.
I'll be honest with you, I haven't had a live sale of my own in probably over 3 years. Grandpa wouldn't understand this at all.
Montgomery and his team sort through shelves holding hundreds of antiques and trinkets.
The box is in good shape, right?
It is in very good shape.
They photograph each item and create a listing in the online portal. Montgomery takes a look at who's biting.
That guy is from Nevada, Las Vegas. This guy is from Greensboro, North Carolina.
But for many communities, auctions are more than just a business transaction. In fact, at the farm sale, most people I talked to weren't there to bid on anything specifically. They wanted to check how things sold and see old friends. Jim Schrader, who lives about 15 miles away, says a lot of times, it's not really about what's being sold.
Did you know that auctions, retirement auction is social? See, it's kind of like a retirement party. So a lot of his friends will be here to tell him, you know, say goodbye and stuff.
And sometimes it's the social ties that push buyers online. Auctions can be emotional, and people may want to avoid in-person competition with their friends.
Some of the guys don't want to be here because they don't want to be shown to be bidding against a neighbor. They want to be anonymous.
The days of vying only against your neighbors for a deal are likely gone. Lauren Beachy, president of Bright Star Auctions in Indiana, says almost all their auctions have internet bidders. And as an Amish man who often serves Amish customers, Beachy has even come up with a way to loop in folks who don't use the internet.
We make a print catalog and we keep a very dynamic mailing list of Amish buyers.
Those potential buyers can call into a conference line to verbally bid.
Amish online bidding, if you will.
But bidding via phone or computer will never quite capture an auction's energy, Beachy says.
There's nothing like the excitement of a good brisk auction. I've never been to a rock concert. But I know that, you know, there's an element of electricity there and excitement.
After all, the hep-hep-hos don't translate that well virtually. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Elizabeth Rembert.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for being along. Join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find our shows through this station's website, and our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.